The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. I'm excited to welcome back James McBride. You know James is the author of the best-selling memoir, The Color of Water, along with a number of best-selling and award-winning novels, including National Book Award winner The Good Lord Bird, Miracle at Santa Ana, Song Yet Sung, and Oprah Book Club pick Deacon King Kong. McBride wears many other hats. He's an award-winning composer, screenwriter, journalist, and saxophonist. He's also a distinguished writer-in-residence at New York University and received the National Humanities Medal from President Barack Obama in 2016. In his new novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, McBride tells the story of a small town's secrets, cultural collisions, and the sustaining love, joy, and friction of a community in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Please welcome back James McBride.
You really like me. Thank you. Thank you very much. Always nice to see the white, nice people who are here today. Very good to see you. And I know a lot of friends here from Variety Club Camp. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And I hope you have a good time. I know it's hard. The last time I was here, I think the COVID thing happened. And I was the last guest of the library. But now that I'm back, it means that we are back. And so it's so good to see so many people. Coming back to Philly is kind of like a homecoming for me. And there are always so many people I want to see and talk to. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of time to do that. But in any case, I want to talk about my new book and tell you why I wrote it. And I just want to share it with you because a lot of it is rooted in here in Philadelphia. Which, you know, it didn't start out that way, but it just ended up that way. I'm just going to read to you for the next 47 minutes, and then after that, we'll have two questions, and I'll see you later. This is just from chapter one of my new book. It's called The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. Chapter one begins like this. There was an old Jew who lived at the site of the old synagogue up on Chicken Hill in the town of Pottstown, PA. And when Pennsylvania troopers found the skeleton at the bottom of an old well off of Hay Street, the old Jew's house was the first place they went to. This was in June 1972, the day after a developer tore up the Hay Street lot to make way for a new townhouse development. "We found a belt buckle and a pendant in the well," cops said, "and some old threads from a red costume or jacket. That's what the lab shows." They produced a piece of jewelry, handed it to him, and asked what it was. "A mezuzah," the old man said. "It matches the one in the door," the cop said. "Don't these things belong on doors?" The old man shrugged. "Jewish life is portable," he said. "The inscription on the back says, home of the greatest dancer in the world. It's in Hebrew. You speak Hebrew?" "Do I look like I speak Swahili?" the man said. "Answer the question. You speak Hebrew or not?" "I bang my head against it sometimes." "And you're Malachi, the dancer, right? That's what they say around here. They say you're a great dancer." "Used to be," he said. "I gave that up 40 years ago." "Then what about the mezuzah? It matches the one here. Wasn't this the Jewish temple?" "It was." "Who owns it now?" they asked. "Who owns everything around here?" the old man said. He nodded at the immense gleaming private school seen through the dim window, the Tucker School. It sat proudly atop the hill behind wrought iron gates with smooth lawns, tennis courts, and shiny classroom buildings, a monstrous bastion of arrogant elegance, glowing like a phoenix above the ramshackle neighborhood of Chicken Hill. "They've been trying to buy me out for 30 years, the old man said. He grinned at the cops, but he was practically toothless, save for a single yellow tooth that hung like a clump of butter from his top gum, which made him look like an aardvark. You're a suspect, they said. Suspect, he said with a shrug. He was well north of 80, wearing an old gray vest, a rumpled white shirt holding several old pens in the vest pocket, a wrinkled towel around his shoulders, and equally rumpled old pants. But when he reached inside his pants pocket, his gnarled hands moved with such deftness and speed that the state troopers, who spent most days ticketing tractor trailers on nearby Interstate 76 and impressing pretty housewives during traffic stops with their bubblegum lights and stern lectures about public safety, panicked and stepped back, their hands on their weapons. But the old man produced nothing more than several pens. He offered the cops one. "No thanks," they said. They milled around for a while long and eventually left, promising to return after they pulled the skeleton out of the well and studied the potential murder scene some more. They never did, though, because the next day God wrapped his hands around Chicken Hill and wrung his last bit of justice out of that wretched place. So that's how the book begins. And what happens is that this book is bookended by a setup that takes place in 1972, and then it jumps back into the 20s and 30s into the town of Pottstown and the area of town known as Chicken Hill, where the blacks and Jews and other people who couldn't afford any better lived. Now, just for those of you who are from Pottstown, let me just give you a couple of disclaimers. This is not really Pottstown. There was a Chicken Hill. These things did not happen in Chicken Hill. This is just a book. It's a novel. It's all made up, as my mother would say. It's all made up. But the essential plot, the plot lines are that Moshe Ludlow is the theater owner in Pottstown, and he decides to book Mickey Katz, the great klezmer artist out of Cleveland. And as he does, he's not very good at being a theater owner, and he's from Romania. He's an immigrant, and so he just blows it. And a local rabbi who owns a grocery store called the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store feels sorry for Moshe and lets him go into his basement to read the Talmud to get his Hebrew and his religious life together. Get it together. And instead, Moshe meets the man's daughter, whose name is Chona. And when Chona enters the book and the picture, she changes everything because he falls in love. They get married. And she ends up running the Heaven and Earth grocery store. And his life as a theater owner booms, and he becomes very successful. And so most of their married life, he's trying to convince her to leave Chicken Hill, but she doesn't want to. Chona Ludlow is a Jewish, born in America Jew, who has polio and is deeply affected by some of the things that anybody who reads a lot, any woman who reads a lot back then might have been affected by. She reads all about Emma Goldman and the crazy socialist and the union busting. And all of this is based on real life. My parents, for those of you, I know there's like maybe three Jews here. But, my mother was raised in Suffolk, Virginia, and her family owned a grocery store on the black side of town. And my grandmother had polio, didn't speak, she spoke only Yiddish, and she lived a very difficult life. And part of the reason why I wrote this book is because my grandmother lived a life without love, really. And I wanted her to be loved, so I put her on the page and made her loved. And so that's part of the reason that this book was created, because there is a part of Jewish life in the 20s and 30s that even a lot of Jews don't pay attention to. And I'm not, by the way, if you're Jewish and you don't like what I say about Jewish people, please, just remember that if you can find two Jews that agree about anything, I'll give you $100 right now, really. You know, it's dangerous stuff to say when Jewish people do this and Jewish people, but I remind you that I was raised by a Jew. Granted, she converted to Christianity, but it doesn't matter. You know, when you are telling the truth, when you're trying to show the truth through humor and love and loyalty and humility, all of these which are based in these characters, people will get it. And if you don't want to get it, then there's nothing I can do to help you in that regard. But so I wanted to show, I was always fascinated by that element of Jewish life, how Jews came to this country. First of all, we all know, well, those of us who are, who read books and newspapers know that the anti-Semitism never really ended when World War II ended. It was just covered with a kind of blanket. And now it's been pulled back, and it's as strong as it ever was. It never went away. So when I was researching my book in Suffolk, Virginia, I was really kind of shocked that, you know, about Anton, because I didn't really understand it at all. But I remember the old Jewish guys I met down, the men and women, they would say, it was life down here was very difficult for us. You know, in those days, they would have signs on the door that said, no dogs, no niggers, and no Jews. And they meant it. I remember Charles Strauss, is that his name? He wrote Annie. Charlie Strauss. I'm in Philadelphia, ain't I? The guy who wrote Annie was Charles Strauss? It's not Charles Schulz. That was Peanuts. Okay, yeah. I knew Charles Strauss. You know, I met him as a, you know, I'm in NASCAP, and, you know, I was in musical theater, blah, blah, blah. And I remember Charles Strauss saying, when he traveled the South with a black singer, he used to play piano, you know, and he went to a place, and they wouldn't serve her. And so Charles said, he said, well, I'm not gonna eat here either. And the guy spit on him. Poof. And Charles still remembered, in a very humorous, he said, I still remember the spit flying out there and going, pap, right on my nice, clean, I had one clean white shirt, he said, just dribbled down. But I recall those stories of, you know, straight out raw anti-Semitism in the South in the 20s and 30s for the Jews who came here from Europe, and how that, you know, how difficult life was for them. And so when I started researching this book, the reason why I wrote this book was not because one of the reasons that this book made it to this form was because I worked here in Philadelphia. When I came, my mother, I'm from New York, but my mother moved to Philly when I was in college. I went to Oberlin. When I came back for the summer, I was looking for a job. I didn't know anybody in Philly. So there was a newspaper ad and it said, dishwasher for a sleepaway camp. So I answered the ad, you know, and it was an old Jewish guy named Bill Saltzman. And so I went to his office and we were talking, and after we talked a while, he said, you know what? You know, you're too smart to be a dishwasher. And he picked up the phone and he said, Sigh, I got a boy here who's too smart to be a dishwasher. Make him a counselor. Click. So I went out to see this man named Cy Friend. And, you know, for those of you who don't know about the Variety Club Camp for Handicapped Children, I'm sure many of you have heard of it. Cy Friend ran that camp for many, many years. I think it was 25 years, Jim. I don't know. A long time. And he really, my experience at that camp changed my life, and it changed the life of many. And I speak for many of the counselors and former counselors of the camp who were there. It serviced 91 kids from Philadelphia with all kinds of disabilities, white, black, Jewish, all that. It was the land was donated by a Romanian Jewish theater owner named, help me out. Leo Postel. Leo Postel donated the land for the camp. And Cy would talk about Leo. Leo was a hard man. He was a hard man because he'd lived a hard life. And so the camp always had this sort of veneer of Jewish sort of philanthropy to it, which was kind of stern. We'll take all you got. Come on in. It's okay. But you better, you know, it's kind of like that. But Cy loved those kids. And if you worked there, and the staff was like a United Nations of long before the word diversity became, you know, commonplace. And Cy himself was quite interesting because he was gay, and he had to hide that. He got married a few years ago, but that was all a big secret. And it says something. I thought about this. I've talked about this many times with Vinnie Carissimi, who's here, one of my former. He should be in jail. But anyway, Vinnie's an attorney who worked at the camp, who got a lot of us out of many legal problems for many years. But, you know, it said something about the trustees of this camp that they knew what Cy was really about, and they didn't say anything. They just let him run the camp. And he ran the camp in the most magnificent way because the cabins weren't air-conditioned. He would say they wanted to air-condition the cabins, and he'd say, no, no air conditioning. They have to be out. They have to be outside. They've been inside all year. And when you read the acknowledgments of the book, it talks about when he went to Widener one time. Widener is the school here that serves the disabled for some 116 years, and how he walked into the auditorium just like that, and all the kids stood up and gave him a standing ovation. This is a guy who really changed life in Philadelphia, and most people don't know who he is. And I wanted to write this book for many years, and I just couldn't do it because there's no way. I've talked about this with Vinnie quite a bit. There's no way you can describe what it's like to be gifted with what these kids had to give us. They gave us more than we. I mean, we were understaffed, underpaid, and all that. But many of the people who worked there excelled in their careers. Many of them. I mean, I see Jim back then, Lou. I mean, there were those of us who worked there. We were kind of became a kind of army of like people who understood that life was bigger than the color of your skin or the religion that you practiced and so forth. And a lot of that, came from Cy. He typified, in my, you know. In my opinion, you know, the business of, you know, heal the world. Tikkun Olam. Really, he really represented that. So I wanted to write a book about that. I tried to, but every time I wrote it, it was like, you know, the camp, and then they went to bed, and then it was the camp, and then they went to... So I was just like, it wasn't any good. But every time I hit the chapter about the guy who donated the land for the camp, the words sprang off the page. They came to life. So I just scrapped all those chapters and went straight to Moshe because, you know, he's the guy who donated the land. And then I went into his story, and that's how this book rolled out. And I went to visit. Now, going back to 2008, I spent a lot of time at Norristown State Hospital where the director and the people there were kind enough to let me in to see how things work there, because when you do research into the disabled children, I'm sure some of you know this, you know, you quickly realize that in the 20s and 30s and 40s, they sent any kind of disabled kid, they would send him to a mental institution. And that was just like, you might as well just, they should have just killed him before they let him walk in the door, really, because those places were just horrible. And so I was going out, and so I went to Norristown State Hospital, and I learned a lot about the history of these places and the people, the many good people who did their best to help find a life for the so-called disabled and the mentally handicapped and so forth. And then I ended up thinking about Pennhurst, because I've read quite a bit about Pennhurst and Byberry and those places. So I was driving out to Pennhurst, and I saw a sign that said Pottstown. And I had initially centered this story in Pottsville, which was way out in near Pittsburgh, where there were a lot more Jews. But Pottstown was a lot closer, you know, okay. So I drove into Pottstown, and I ended up researching the book there. I went to the Historical Society, I went to the library. This is all during COVID, by the way. And, you know, historical societies, man, I'm telling you. Well, there's weird people run historical societies. But if you get them, you know, if you can just kind of convince them that you are, you know, that you're really interested in the history, they will, they'll show you the way. And out there, I got really lucky and ran into two or three people who really understood the history of Pottstown. And then I got into Chicken Hill and I interviewed some of the Chicken Hill residents and read a couple of dissertations. And so I just set the story there. So what happens in this book is that Moshe and Chona, his wife, what happens is they end up with a deaf 12-year-old black child who ends up in their home. And they find themselves trying to protect him from the state of Pennsylvania, which wants to institutionalize him. And the people who placed him in that home are Nate and Addie Timlin, who were the couple that worked for this Jewish couple. And as the pressure mounts, you know, because Chona is so outspoken about things anyway, as the pressure mounts against Chicken Hill to get this boy from this couple, and the black community starts to get involved and they start to bring up their defenses, they become kind of like a force that work together to keep this kid where he belongs. And then the whole book is about the struggle to make sure this kid gets where he belongs and the struggle behind the justice that happens behind and I don't want to spoil it for you, behind an injustice that takes place during the course of this narrative. So, you know, there's been a lot's been said about the black and Jewish community. And, you know, you're walking in dangerous ground when you start talking about the Jew, you know, because there ain't no the Jew. They're Jewish people who are human beings. They're black people. They're Latino people. It's all about humanity. But oftentimes the narrative when discussing blacks and Jews, you know, centered around some kind of negative activity, like the Newark riots, and he tore it up, and then, oh, we can't walk there because it's a crime. You know, every time there's a black person, it's the crime. You know, it's always this bunch of stereotypes and prejudicial nonsense. Philly always used to be, when I was here, a place where you kind of couldn't get away with that too much because we were all kind of in each other's faces here. And there was a much larger working class place, much larger working class population. You know, you were an artist, you could make it here at $300 a month and still live on 23rd and Spruce, which I did at one point, and kind of make it. You know, you knew how, and that doesn't seem like that exists anymore. In a small town in the 20s and 30s and 40s, that did exist, and people were forced to get along. And I guess at bottom, the book is about the same thing that Cy and the children of Variety Club Kent taught us, which is it's about equality. I mean, it's draped in a narrative where, you know, they're trying to get this kid, and they get him, and then they got to bust him loose, and, you know, and Nate and Addie, you know, and the black people get, you know, get active, and then suddenly, you know, but really, it's just about equality. And one of my favorite chapters in the book is late in the book when Nate has a conversation with Moshe's cousin. Moshe walked 800 miles from Romania all the way to Hamburg, and then him and his cousin Isaac, they rolled cigars in the basement of a woman's house in Hamburg for 3 years to earn passage to America. But Moshe is always kind-hearted, and he never has a harsh word. But Isaac, on the other hand, is strong. And you know, he was the guy who led them along, and he becomes rich and ruthless and powerful. And one of my favorite chapters is when Isaac and Nate have it out. You know, they basically sketch out what's going to happen. And their two views of America is really worth the read. There are other characters in this book that are worth, you know, discussing, like the Skupskelis twins, who were shoemakers in Pottstown, and also Miggy Flood, who was from Hemlock Row, who's from South Carolina, you know, from Gullah Country. There's a lot of dimension between these various characters. So, you know, you're meeting Romanian Jews and Bulgarian Jews, and you're meeting blacks from the South and blacks from Pennsylvania and blacks from Gullah Country, Low Country in South Carolina. And these are all different people. And it's just all about appreciating the differences between these characters. And that's what makes this book go, because they're all different, but they're all aiming at the same thing. And finally, you know, one of the things I tried to do in this book is to really show how, you know, as different as we are, there's parts of the old country that we need to keep and parts of the old country that we need to leave behind. And we, you know, we're not sure. We're never quite sure about what, you know, what that is that we should keep and what that is we should leave behind. And that's really the debate for those of us who care about this country. That's really our debate. What do we keep from the old country and what do we leave behind? And that really rolls into religion as well, because a lot of things involving religion have really gotten out of hand, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a fairly religious person. Some of this stuff has just gotten out of hand. Doesn't matter what religion you're talking about. Too much religion. For me personally, I've had enough. I don't need any more Jesus. I don't need any more, you know, Muhammad. I don't need it, enough of that. You know, this church and state, and then there's, you know, the thoughts and prayers, fake bots. And, you know, and then there's the rest of us who are trying to get along and to do good. Every religion has a section that says, let's just do good. Let's heal the world. Let's make each other better. And that's where my books more or less live. So, well, I've been gabbing now for a good half hour. I hope I've told you enough about the book. Have I, or do you want to hear more? No? Okay. More? Oh, well, you know. That's not, I mean, that's, how am I going to make money if I tell you what happens in the book? All right, I'll go through the chapters and I'll give you an idea what's in the chapters, and then maybe there's something there that can, because I don't really like to read that much. Chapter 1 is about the hurricane. Chapter 2 is a bad sign. Really, I'm not kidding. Well, chapter 2 is where I roll out Malachi, who you meet in chapter 1. Malachi is an interesting character. He's from Europe. He doesn't like America. He becomes very good friends with Moshe. And he helps Moshe a lot. In fact, his reappearance, we meet him early in the book, and then he disappears. And when he reappears again, he brings so much good fortune. He's like a wizard. He's like a wizard. He kind of, I try to dabble a little bit in the sort of spiritual, magical realism, folklorism that exists in Judaism in that during that period. Now, don't tell me it didn't exist. I really don't want to have that conversation with you. So, and Malachi was a lot of fun. He was a great dancer, and he was, you know, he was looking for a wife, but he was, you know, but then he goes and dances with every woman he can find. And chapter 3 is about 12, and this is about Moshe's rise to, you know, to middle class life. Then you move into Dodo, and Dodo is the kid. Dodo is the kid. His hearing gets damaged when he's 12. There's a stove blows up in his house, and his hearing is damaged, and his eyes are damaged. But his eyes come back, but his ears don't. And so he ends up with his mother dies. She just gets sick and dies in a year or so, and he ends up with Nate and Addie, who is the sister of it. Addie is the sister of his mother. And the state wants him because Dodo doesn't want to go to school anymore. He can't hear what's going on, and he doesn't want to go to school. So the state shows up at Nate's house and says, we're going to take this kid, and we're going to put him in a special place. And so Nate approaches Moshe and says, listen, can you do me a favor? Can we just leave him in the basement of the theater for a few days till a man from the state goes away? Because, you know, one colored, they're not going to stretch themselves too hard looking for a colored child. So Moshe is afraid to do it because, you know, he hears the word the government, you know, and that just panics him. But he puts him in the basement of the theater, and then he goes home and tells his wife. And when he tells his wife, we put him in the basement of the theater because they got a special school for people like him. Jonah gets mad and says, bring him home. So he brings him home, and he brings a whole lot of trouble with it. But Dodo becomes part of that family. And then it moves along to Malachi's reappearance. And then the whole business of rolling out the people who, at the end of this book, move into action to help Dodo. And that would be Fatty Davis, who's a local juke joint owner. His name is Fatty, and his friend, Enzo Carissimi, so named for the very, very real Vincent Carissimi, who sits right here in the front. I needed someone who was big, ugly, and white. And what do you know? It was just, Enzo Carissimi is named Big Soap. And he's from, just to cover myself, because Vinny's a lawyer, no relation to the real Vinny Carissimi. But I needed a character. Fatty and Soap, their relationship, their friendship is very important because both of them are a little bit near to dudes. You know, they grew up, when Enzo came to the United States, he was 12, he couldn't speak English good, but Fatty could speak enough English good for both of them. So they're working together at a plant, and they get in trouble because they're supposed to clean a room. A big shot from Philly shows up, and they're supposed to scrub the place good, but, you know, they didn't. And it was really Fatty's fault, so he lets Big Soap punch him in the face to even things out, and he knocks out Fatty's gold tooth. And so that becomes a little bit of a thing. Fatty has to come to Philadelphia to get a wooden tooth, and he ends up working in North Philly, and he ends up I just drag all the Quakers and I just got everybody in there. But Fatty and Enzo Fatty and Big Soap are crucial characters because later on we discover that the shul that Chona and all the 17 Jewish families of Pottstown go to, they're getting their water illegally because when they first started the shul, the farmer whose well provided the water for Chicken Hill refused to let them run a pipe from his well. So what happened was the shul just hired like the best builder in town, which happened to be Fatty Davis's father. And Fatty Davis's father dug a well, and he just attached a pipe to this anti-Semitic farmer's well water, and he's pumping the money to the pumping the water to the shul. And that works all well and good until, you know, 35 years later, when his father's dead, and they're finding out the mikvah has a frog in it, and this, you know, they're trying to figure out where this stuff is coming from, so they got to go back and dig that well out and, you know, attach the water to the right place. All right, so in any case, Fatty and Big Soap, Fatty's the only one in town who knows where that pipe is buried. And all of this is tied into the justice that needs to be meted out for what happens to Chona. Because Chona is the key character in this. She's the key person in this book. And one of the most interesting parts about the book is when Fatty and his sister start fighting about it. Because Fatty's sister and Chona were good friends when they were kids. And then gradually they grew apart. And when Fatty and his sister Bernice start to fight about Chona, the discourse between them is pretty interesting because it pings into the kinds of discourse that you hear when black people are talking about Jewish people. Because there's this kind of there's a love-hate thing going on. There's a respect and disrespect going on. And I suspect it happens amongst Jewish people as well. My only advice to you about that is that while we are wasting time quibbling about nothing, this country's going down a hole. And so we've got to act as one. We have to move like one. The time for debating all this stuff is over. The time for action, really, real action, is now. And even if you don't like the person who's doing it, you don't agree with them completely, we can have that debate after the war is done. But right now, we're in the middle of it. And you're in Philadelphia. You know, I know what's happening here. I can see it. I can tell by the paper, the crime, the tax problem, all this stuff. We have to stay strong now. We are no longer in the era of John and Milton Street and Bill Coleman and these guys who used to fist fight and, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck, whoever these people in City Hall. You know, the clown days are over. This is about the future of this city and this country for our children and our grandchildren. The days of when you could pick up the Philadelphia Bulletin and the Philadelphia Daily News and the Philadelphia Inquirer and read local news are gone, in part because so few of you subscribe to Philly.com. You know, the days of local news where we knew what was going on down the street are done. You know, Variety Club Kent, when they wanted to raise money, all they did was went down to the hotel. They said, we're going to be at the ball field. And thousands of people would show up and give $5. Now, most of us only know, we know what happened in, you know, Toledo, Ohio, better than what happened a block away. Because we're not paying attention to what's going on. And that's what they like. I don't own a TV, so I don't know what's going on. But I can tell you, it's sort of like being a witness in Rwanda when they were broadcasting the, go get them, and everyone's listening to the radio, were brainwashed. The brainwashing has got to stop. Read, after you finish this book, of course, after you finish this book, pick up The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. And then read about what happened to William Shirer after he lost his job at CBS. He was dead on his feet. He was done. He wrote this book, and when the book came out, the German press, this is terrible. That book predicted, that book is predictive of our future if we don't pay attention. But I don't want to get into politics. I'm just trying to sell a book. And on that note, I'll open the floor to any questions that you might have. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Matt Reed. Nice to finally meet you. The Color of Water changed my life. I'm from Pottstown, PA. Just wanted to get that out the way. I'm an educator. I'm quite well aware of historical fiction. But thank you for making a mistake to come to Pottstown, because Pottsville and Pottstown so often get confused together. When I heard about this, my mind exploded. Mrs. Johnson, who you interviewed, was my guidance counselor in high school. Okay. She unfortunately passed away about a month ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So she couldn't see this book to its fruition. Good friends with her daughter. You got to come to Pottstown High to speak to the students. And if you do that, I want to be there. I want to be there. I don't really have a question. I just want to thank you. I'm so excited and pumped up that you made this book in my hometown.
Thank you very much. Well, yes. If I was a young person, I would move to Pottstown, because Pottstown has beautiful housing. It's a place for artists. I mean, it's got beautiful. The people are very. I mean, really, it's really cheap, because nobody, because people just overlook it. It's one of those. Pennsylvania, this state is full of towns like that. Beautiful housing, and everyone's trying to get to Center City and live on South Street. When you could go to a place like Pottstown, you can have a whole house. And I know, I follow the events. I read about the gas explosion out there and how they never figured out what happened. I mean, Chicken Hill still exists. It has beautiful housing there. There's a lot of working class people still in Pottstown. Pottstown needs help. And if this book is any help to the town of Pottstown, because this is a place where businessmen came, the corporate fathers came, they built their factories, and then it was cheaper to build their widgets and bridges and steel nipples somewhere, they moved right out and went somewhere else. And so these buildings still exist. And so, yeah, I'll try to come to Pottstown. I can't do it like right away, but the thing is that when you're dealing with like a fictional book and a real book, people who are in, Mrs. Johnson was, I happened to, when I met Glenda Johnson, was her name? Charlene Johnson. When I met her, I just happened to stumble into like one of the living historians of Pottstown, who was, she was extremely smart. She knew, she pulled out pictures of, and she knew, she knew every, Pottstown has a lot of famous people that can, Al Gray, the trombonist, and several Major League Baseball players. I mean, it has quite a history. And it has quite an integrated history. And it had a paper, the Mercury, Pottstown Mercury, which was a leading civil rights, a leading sort of proponent of civil rights. It was edited by a guy named Sandy Hill. And he wrote a book called, it was called Dear Sir, You Cur. So you can see that people didn't like him out there. Because, you know, Sandy Hill was a, he was a, he was a, he was a pioneer. Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that you appreciate what I tried to do.
This may not be as related to the discussion today, but I was wondering for you what some differences were between writing for a book and screenwriting.
Writing for screenwriting is you're dealing mostly with muscle. You know, you have to place a character, and whatever they say has to cover a lot of territory. So you have to be careful. Everything you see, every small element has to tell a little bit of a story. In a novel or in a nonfiction book, you have space to lay in backstory to show why this character is acting the way they do and so forth. Although you don't have as much space in a novel as you think. I mean, there's very little editorial business in this book, in Heaven and Earth Grows. There's one piece of editorial business that involves the dancers from the days of yore. Let me see if I can. Yeah. Well, you know, Moshe, when he gets going with his Jewish theater. See, he's the first theater in Pottstown that welcomes blacks. He brings, after Mickey Katz made him so much money, he said, well, maybe I shouldn't. And one of his, Nate says, you know, I haven't had so much, you know, haven't had any fun because if you're black, you got to go to a juke joint to hear good music. And so Moshe goes to his wife and says, maybe I should just invite Chick Webb to come play. And she says, well, you know, their money spends just like ours. So he brings in Chick Webb, Chick Webb was basically discovered Ella Fitzgerald. Chick Webb also was a handicapped person. He had a bent spine and so forth. And then all these black bands start coming in, and Moshe's making real good money now because he opened his theater to black people, and so that makes the town people mad. So Moshe decides to cool things out. He invites some of the bands that the townspeople like. And so I'll read what I wrote about that. To make peace with the town powers, every month or so, Moshe booked a bevy of horrible bands that Pottstown's high-class, pasty-faced Presbyterians enjoyed just to keep the peace. They were named the Colonial Dames of America, the Pennsylvania Potting Club, the 19 Mountain People whose 14th cousin arrived on the Mayflower, etc. The bands were horrible outfits that sounded like owls hooting. Moshe watched in puzzlement as these Americans danced with clumsy satisfaction at the moans and groans of these boneless, noise-producing junk mongers. I mean, that was that was the one place where I just had fun editorializing. But generally, I don't do it. You know, even some of the antagonists in the story, like Doc Roberts, who's the town doctor, and he watches in the Ku Klux Klan and so forth. I show the real life. There's a sympathetic side to people that we don't agree with. We might not agree about a lot, but you don't do the reader or yourself any justice when you show someone that's totally evil. You know, I mean, there are a few people who are totally. I can think of one person, but I, you know, in general, people are trying to do the right thing, even people we don't agree with. So that was one section there where I just had some fun, you know, poking fun at, you know, that music, and they're clogging, you know, with their hands behind their back, and Moshe just says, you know, no self-respecting Jewish woman wear clogs, and you know, but that's the only time I really editorialize. So in short answer to your question is, in a novel, you don't really have that, a good book, a good novel, you don't really have a lot of time to editorialize. You show, and you let the reader decide what's good and what's not good. And that was just really a fun section there. It wasn't written with the kind of, you know, viciousness that you see in books where someone's just You know. Sometimes I meet writers, and they're like, they're so nice, and they smell good, and their teeth are clean. And then you read what they write, it's like, oh man, the head got a lot blood spurting out. You know, I mean, can't you get your rocks off some other way? Really, I mean, can't you just tell your story some kind of other way? So I'm not one of those types. In general, you know, my general philosophy is if you can't say it when the person in the same room, you just probably ought not to say it. If you can't write it, if the person's in the same room, then you ought not to write it. Because you're not here to insult people and show them your power. You don't really have that much power. You're just trying to illuminate and hope someone walks to the corner that you illuminated. Many years ago, what Bill Saltzman did for me was he just illuminated a little bit of a corner for me. And I knew him for a long time, and I appreciate it. I mean, yes, he was prejudiced, but we all prejudiced. And anyone says they're not prejudiced, probably lying, really. It doesn't matter. We don't have to get microscopic about it, you know. I mean, it's okay. You know, if you say nigger, it's not the end of the world. But look, personally, I don't care what you call me as long as you don't call me late for supper. But, you know, some people, you know, I mean, and I understand that, you know, the business behind the words and all that stuff, but the words don't mean anything if you don't. What do the words say? What does the action that follows it? You know, when I went, my first story in the Boston, when I was at the Boston Globe, they sent me out to do a story about a priest. His name was Father Waldron. And I knocked on the door, you know, I had a big afro, and I looked good. I looked good. It was the old days, man. So I was like 22 or something. I knocked on the door and I said, excuse me, I said, I'm James McBride from the Boston Globe. I'm here to see Father Waldron. And the lady said, nigger, get out of here. I said, but I'm from the Boston Globe. She said, I don't care where you're from, nigger, get out of here, and slammed the door in my face. So this was before cell phones. So I walked down the street. I called the city desk. And I said, you know, this is James McBride. I'm new. I'm working in the living section. And, you know, this lady's calling me names. I'm supposed to go. And the guy said, whoever picked up the phone, look, if you work for a paper, you don't know everybody at the paper. I was new. And the guy said, well, so she's calling you names, huh? Get back to work. And he hung up. So I called the parish, and I asked for Father Waldron. I got him on the phone. I said, Father Waldron, this is James McBride from the Boston Globe. I'm supposed to be doing a story about you. He said, oh, come on down. I said, I'm down the street. Come on down. So I went and I knocked on the door, and he opened the door. When he saw me, he said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And he explained to me that they had taken in this woman. They didn't know what to do with her. She just happened to be there. She happened to open the door when I came in. And they had to do something with her. And Father Waldron worked in Roxbury for most of his career. He died like about a year ago. And I knew him all after that time. This is 1981. And if I had let that woman's word turn me away from, you know, well, I had a job. I had to get the story anyway. But look what happened as a result of that. I mean, so you have to look at, I'm not saying that you should go around using the N-word. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that you have to pick your battles. And the battle there was to get the story. And look what happened at the end. So people say, well, you're optimistic. No, I'm not optimistic. I'm realistic. People try to do the right thing. You know, when someone calls you a name, it's just a bunch of letters. Your name's a bunch of letters. You could be like Toenail, you know. Instead of Harry, you could be, you know, Fussy. You could be a Booger. You could be anything. So, I mean, you can't let this stuff stop you from the business of living and trying to do right. And we've got to do that now. We're at the point where we have to do that. That's one of the things that was really forced on us at Variety Club Camp, because disabled children, so-called disabled children, they don't waste time with the kind of stuff that you and I waste time with. And then in this book, there's a character named Monkey Pants. When the state finally catches up to him. A great injustice occurs, and despite Shona's best efforts, the state finally catches up with him, and they lock him in Pennhurst. And I spend 3 chapters with Dodo in Pennhurst, and he meets a kid named Monkey Pants. And his relationship with Monkey Pants, who has cerebral palsy. And those of us who worked with kids who have so-called cerebral palsy understand that while what we're looking at might be someone whose face is gnarled and they're twisted and all, but inside them they have 1,000 thoughts, only a small, minute piece that can come out to us. They are the true invisible people. They're like Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, because they've been watching us all their lives. They know us. We don't know them. And so the relationship between Dodo and Monkey Pants is a crucial element in this book. And really, it's the motor behind the whole thing, because the disabled have so much to teach us. And it took a long time for this book to be, for that whole business to shape itself, because it's a novel. And it's organic. And the organic quality of it, I think, is what keeps it together.
I've been reading it since it was out on Tuesday, and I've just gotten to Monkey Pants. And one of the things that has been really acute for me in this, as well as your other books, has been the treatment of the individualizing of voices within vernaculars, so that each, without overdoing it. And so my first question is do you set yourself, for instance, if you've got Italian characters like the Drunk in the Project book, do you set yourself any bumpers, I guess?
Well, you know, I try to find the slang and the colloquial stuff that the characters would actually say. You know, when a Jewish, when Moshe gets angry, he's not going to say, you know, I'm gonna kick your tail. He'll say, you know, I'll knock your He'll find something that's a Yiddish phrase that has the same punch, but it's just different. So you know, I work very hard at dialogue in all my books. So I rewrite dialogue constantly until it's to all the fat's out of it. I mean, the whole business of screenplays, because I've written a lot of screenplays, I tend to try to use dialogue to push the story along a lot quicker. Like when my students write, when they hand me, I make my students write in longhand. I don't allow them to write on a computer. Because if you write on a computer, you know what happens is you write a paragraph and then you insert, you know. Then you write another paragraph and then you insert. Then you insert. Then after a while, you walk around, you're like, why is this not working? It's not working because there's something in your head when you have a pen or a pencil, or even a typewriter, that just organizes it so that it has flow, because you don't want to have to go back and start scratching it on. So with dialogue, I do the same thing. And, you know, that dialogue business with the Italian characters, with Pia and Mr. The Fabby Bakery people, the Sicilian, the way that she talks Italian, like a Sicilian rather than a Northern. I mean, that stuff takes a lot of time, but, you know, readers know. So I'm better with that than I am actually pronouncing the words, you know, personally, as you can tell. But yeah.
And what was your choice behind translating the Yiddish, but not the Italian?
I can't know how deep you are in, but at some point, well, first of all, when I did the Yiddish, I did it in italics. Because I did parts of it in Italian, just enough so the reader knows we're still in Yiddish, more or less, in places. With Italian, there's a big section, and I don't think you've reached it yet, where Big Soap's mother shows up at the juke joint, and she just launches into a straight-up-and-down Italian tirade, you know, and all these guys are standing there laughing at Big Soap while his mother's just wearing them out. I think most of that between her and him is Italian with translations. And then he translates for her when she's trying to find out what happened at the store. What happens in the book is that something bad happens in Chona's store, and Big Soap's mother she finds out about it, and she wants to know, and so she marches up to Fatty's juke joint and starts demanding answers. She's a little Italian lady from, you know, she starts watering these big cats around. Get over there, you know. So I just do enough so the reader knows this is Italian. But not too much. It just has to pass the sniff test with me, you know, because I don't want the reader to say, you know, I'm not trying to show how good I am at Italian, which I'm not very good at. I'm just trying to show the moment, you know. When you're in music, how many times have you gone to a music like a jazz concert and the thing starts at 7 o'clock, and 3 hours pass, and you look at your watch and it's 7:15, you know. Really, how big, you know, because the guy, don't try this at home. You know, you're like, wait a minute. Is Frank Sinatra in here? Can we just, like, you know, nice work if you can get it. You can get it if you try. I mean, you're looking for melody. So what happens in that case is that the person is always telling, you can't, remember Quincy Jones once said, you don't tell the same joke twice. In music, he was talking about. And in books, it's the same way. Once you get that character in place, no matter what language it is, your responsibility is to make sure the reader is going to stick. They'll stick a little bit with some, you know, Yiddish or Italian or German or, you know, Irish brogue, but not too much. I mean, if you're Malachi McCoy, you can pull it off. But if me, you're not. You know, I once did a reading with Malachi McCoy, by the way. This is, you want to hear this?
Yeah.
All right, well, listen to this. I was in Australia. This is, I had first got started, you know, Color Water came out, you know, and I was making people laugh. Like, you haven't really lived until you've done, like, a Jewish book club in Teaneck, New Jersey with the Color of Water with 10 Jewish women. This, and let's check his teeth. Okay. Oh, yeah. So, Malachi. I was in Australia, you know, and Malachi and I were backstage and they were trying to decide who would go first. I didn't know anything about, you know, I confess, I didn't know anything about Irish humor and I didn't know anything about the McCourt brothers. So I said to Malachi, and Malachi, you know, we're both from New York, we're chatting. So, you know, so Malachi said, well, you know, you want to go first? I said, no, Malachi. I said, you go first, man, because I'm kind of funny, you know. He said, all right. Man, he got out there, and 5 minutes later, old men were like, ah, you just cracking. They were cracking. These are Australians, by the way. He said, hey, and he went to the judge, and the judge said, I mean, it was just so funny. And then I had to follow that. So, you know, what I learned from him is that, you know, with Irish brogue and humor and timing, it all works. It works on the page and works on books as well. So I'm always mindful of that, you know, when it comes to language and it comes to dialogue. So whether the language is, whatever the language is, you want to keep it short, you want to keep it curt, keep it direct, and you want to try to make it a little bit funny.
James, how are you?
Good.
I read a book by Michael Eric Dyson, The Tears We Cannot Stop. He gave advice to white people and said that one of the things that we can do to help advance racial equality is to become racially literate. And I want to thank you and your writing for helping me advance along that road of racial literacy. So thank you.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. See now. Well, listen, you know, what this packed house has to show us is that we are doing our best to get along. And that's what my books try to do, and that's what we tried to do at Variety Club Camp. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way. The most important thing to remember is that as long as you can say, I'm sorry I made a mistake, there's always a chance. That's it. It's real simple. I'm sorry I made a mistake, and it will never happen again. That's what Grover Washington, you know, someone asked Grover, I work with Grover Washington, and I wrote two songs for him. We recorded them here in Philly at Sigma Sound. It was great. And somebody asked Grover, the late Grover, he was, by the way, really a pioneer musician. When you think about this smooth jazz and Kenny G and all that, Grover was way ahead of all those people. A guy who drove a SEPTA bus, took a day off work, and recorded Mr. Magic, which is a jazz classic. I mean, he was just a real statesman of life. But someone asked Grover, they said, how did you stay married so long, you know? And Grover said, look, three words. It's all my fault. I'm sorry, and it'll never happen again. So that, with that sage advice, I will leave you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.